Nightlife Science.
Joining us on the line is for a look this week at science is Charlie Lineweaver. Charlie, good evening and welcome back to Nightlife.
Good evening, you curious and syphilated Homo sapien earthling.
Well, yes, one who doesn't really understand gravitational waves, but this has all moved very quickly. I remember just a few years ago I was broadcasting on another station when the first gravitational wave was detected. And hey, presto, now they seem as, well, not quite as common as muck, but there have been heaps of new detections of gravitational waves, Charlie.
Well, my first question, Phil, for you is, how common is muck? No. All right, so seriously, so what has happened in the last 5 years? The first detection of a gravitational wave by human beings was in 2015,
and
the people who did this already have received a Nobel Prize in this, in physics. But since that time, the world has not been inactive. And so there are two detectors now in the U.S. There's one in Europe called Virgo in Italy, and there's one active in Japan now called Kagra. And just a couple of weeks ago, this international consortium of 1,662 astrophysicists, I mention this number because I've never seen 10 pages of names and affiliations at the beginning of a paper before, but that was the case. And what they announced was, we have 35 new events. That brings the total to 90 detections of collisions between black holes and black holes, and black holes and neutron stars, and even a couple of neutron stars, neutron star collisions. So these send out, when they collide, they send out gravitational waves, and that's the bending of space and time. They propagate at the speed of light. And if they're very big, then they get detected by these very, very sensitive gravitational wave detectors. And this was the latest catalog that was put out by this consortium. And they have wonderful things. They have black holes that are bigger than we expect. They have one that's 85 solar masses. And this is presumably from a stellar evolution. So that's unexpected. And then, on the other hand, there's a little caveat, and that is that something like 10% of these have such low signal to noise that they might be spurious. They might be false positives. And so you got to watch out for those. Any catalog like this with many, many objects, you have to figure out, oh, they're not all the real detections. Some fraction of them are false. And so they gave warnings about that. In any case, but there's another thing you may not have heard, or maybe you did hear, that a couple of years ago, there was a neutron star collision that was detected with gravitational waves. And the reason why that's important is because when that happens, other telescopes from around the world were able to see the event in the sky. This is not true when you have a black hole collision because the light gets...
There's no light. It can't escape.
There's no light. Well, there is a tiny bit of light, but it's just nothing like when a neutron star collide, and then all the light can escape, and it's just a very energetic... And then we learn from such things, we can look at them with other telescopes, and we can learn things about what types of elements were produced in this neutron star collision. And we learned an awful lot about how what are some elements in the periodic table were produced. It was kind of a mystery until we saw this neutron star collision. And that's what a new proposal for the, well, you know, Phil, you've heard of gamma rays, X-rays, radio, infrared. Those are all electromagnetic radiation. They have different wavelengths, right?
Right.
Well, in gravitational waves, you have the exact same things. When two tiny black holes collide, they go very high frequency. But two supermassive black holes, they're like that. And so then you need a different type of gravitational wave detector. And so in the future, there will be gravitational wave detectors that are optimized for very high frequency, like neutron star ones, or optimized for very low frequency, like supermassive black holes during the collisions of galaxies.
So in the cosmic orchestra, there are tiny flutes and big bassoons.
That's right. And
Charlie.
Actually, that's a little bit inappropriate because with your ear, your human ear, you can hear all of those, right?
But these you can't hear.
Some sounds that you cannot hear because they're they're much higher frequency that you cannot hear, and some sounds are low frequency that you cannot hear. So you have to build separate instruments to get those different extremes of frequency, and that's what has been going on over the last 200 years in electromagnetic radiation, and that's what will go on in the next 100 years for gravitational waves.
Okay, all right. Now, now's a good time to see a dwarf planet Ceres for yourself. You will need a pair of binoculars or a little telescope.
Yeah.
Where do you look?
Well, you look. Well, have you been looking?
Hang on. Dwarf planet. Oh, this is, where is it? It's in between what?
Okay, first of all, it's a dwarf planet. Now, you may be aware that there used to be 9 planets in the solar system. And then
there were 8 because we junked Pluto, yeah.
That's right. But Pluto, when it got junked, it stopped becoming a planet, but it became a dwarf planet.
Oh, okay.
And a dwarf planet is one that's spherical. It's big enough to be spherical, but not massive enough to have cleared its orbit.
Where's this? Where's Ceres then?
Well, Ceres is in the asteroid belt.
Oh, okay. Right.
So it used to be, for about 50 years, it was thought to be a planet, but then they detected another object in its orbit and another and another. And now we know of thousands and thousands of asteroids at pretty much the same orbit as Ceres. And so it says, okay, you're not a planet anymore. You're an asteroid. And then when we were trying to demote Pluto, we had to create a new category called dwarf planets.
Anyway, so you can actually see this thing, can you, with a pair of binoculars?
That's right. You can, and if you've been walking at night, you can see Orion. Yeah. And next to Orion, you can see the constellation Taurus, and the brightest star in Taurus is a star. It's a red star called Aldebaran. Mm. I don't know if you can recognize the V-shaped of the head of Taurus, but right now Ceres is very close to the sharp point of the V. And the V is made from a constellation of it's a star cluster called Hyades. It's very close. It's 153 light years away. So it's one of the closest star clusters to us. And if you have a telescope, you can go out tonight and look very close to the sharp point of the V of the head of Taurus, and you will see Ceres, a dwarf planet.
Okay. Fun. Pity about the cloud for afflicting much of the East Coast, but there you go. Now, astronomers also found a second Trojan asteroid, which shares Earth's orbit.
Yeah.
Is this a worry or not?
No. Well, actually, I guess it's kind of a demonstration that we astronomers are making progress in keeping track of all of the stuff in the local universe that could potentially hit the Earth. And one of those things is a Trojan. Now, a Trojan, remember, is an object that shares the orbit of the Earth. Actually, they were first discovered in Jupiter. So these Trojans and the Greeks, these are asteroids, essentially, that follow Jupiter in its orbit by 60 degrees and lead Jupiter in its orbit by 60 degrees. And the same thing can happen with the Earth. The Earth goes around the sun once a year, leading by 60 degrees are some Greeks and trailing are some Trojans. And we've just found, but we've only found 2. In the case of Jupiter, we found thousands and thousands of them. But in the case of Earth, only 2. But the big news is we found the second one. And so that just tells you that we're keeping track of things around the Earth.
Yeah, no, exactly. All right, now, what's this about a strange quantum effect that was predicted 30 years ago but has now been observed? What's this?
Yeah, this is a little bit hard to describe because, like all quantum effects, it's kind of weird. It's an effect called Pauli blocking. Now, Pauli was a great quantum physicist, and he discovered the Pauli exclusion principle. Basically, there are particles called fermions. It's just a fancy word for electron or proton or neutron. These are particles with spins. Spin 1/2. Mm-hmm. And when you have these particles together, they do not like to be. As a matter of fact, they will not be in the same state, quantum state. And so you can do all you want to push them together. They will not share the same state. And so when you get a bunch of fermions in this gas, it's called a Fermi C, actually, and you cool them down, make them very dense, when you get them, they kind of freeze in place. They're unable to move. They can't change states. And when that's the case, and it's very hard to do to get them in this, because usually when you compress them in high density, you heat them up. But you have to cool them down, in this case, to form a Fermi C. When you cool them down, you shine light through them, and light, it doesn't get absorbed. The things become transparent. Why is that? Because they're fixed in place. They're locked in place, and they can't move. And therefore, if light hits them, they would have to move, but they can't move. And so the whole gas even this dense cold gas becomes transparent completely. And so three separate experiments in the past few weeks have come out with results saying, we have verified that this prediction is in fact true, that this stuff, this Fermi C, this Fermi gas does become transparent as you get colder and colder and denser and denser.
Okay. All right. Now, canine.
You will not see this in your refrigerator. It's not cold enough. We're talking about temperatures of like close to zero Kelvin.
Oh, like that's absolute zero. That's as cold as you can get, isn't it?
That's it. Just above that, absolute zero.
Why can't you get any cold? Oh, no, actually, I know the answer to that.
You do.
You can't get any colder than absolute zero because that's when things stop moving completely, don't they?
Well, almost. You get there's the minimum amount of motion. Let's just say it's not that they stop moving completely; they move at the minimum amount.
Now, canine teeth shrank in human ancestors at least 4.5 million years ago, marking a reduction in male to male aggression. Really?
Well, this is research done just past week, came out by a group in University of Tokyo.
Yes.
And what they did, if you look at a chimpanzee, I don't know if you've ever seen a chimpanzee or a gorilla, particularly go ahead.
They've got big teeth.
The males have large, very large canines, not the females, but the males. Mm-hmm. And so we are an ape. We don't have a tail. But if we look at our closest ancestors, our closest relatives, not our ancestors, our relatives, the chimps and the gorillas and the orangutans, the males have these gigantic canines, both upper canines and lower canines. And so what these scientists did was, hey, I'm going to measure these canine differences. Mm-hmm. And they found that in chimps and gorillas, the males had canines that were about 30% bigger than females.
Right.
But when you do it in humans, you say, hey, there's hardly any difference. Maybe only instead of 30% larger, maybe it's only 5% larger in humans. So then they ask the question, well, when did that happen? Well, we know that chimps and humans diverged about 7 million years ago. We know the fossil record gets increasingly sparse as we look further and further back. But they did this for about 6 million years, maybe 5.5. And they found that humans had this reduced canines for at least the last 4.5 million years.
Okay.
And then they say, well, why is that? Why is it that human males got rid of their large canines? Because they look at other apes and they see that males fight with each other and they use these large canines as weapons. So the implication is that maybe women were selecting males who didn't fight with each other as much.
Oh, okay.
That's the point. You're choosing males who don't fight with each other as much because you don't want, you don't want male-male collisions in the household. Now, this is interesting because you may not know, but maybe you do, that humans learned how to walk bipedally before they got the big brains. Big brains only happened in the last 3 million years. We were walking on 2 feet 4 or 5 million years ago.
We're being walky, but we couldn't chew gum because our brain wasn't big enough.
Okay, that's worth three. That's half a laugh. Anyway, so the point is that we got rid of these large canines in males also early when we learned how to walk before we had big brains. And that's kind of interesting detail how we evolved to be who we are.
Interesting. Now, look, just finally, this is interesting. We all know about DNA, and you can identify people from their DNA. The question is, can a person's DNA be matched to a photograph of their face?
Yeah, so this is a privacy issue, very secure issue. I mean, we're interested in, keeping our own details to ourselves. But as you know, I donated my DNA to 23andMe to figure out, so it would tell me where my ancestors came from and who I'm related to. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of an interesting genealogical project. But more and more, full genomes, all 3 billion base pairs, are being used to figure out, let me back up. You have a face that has very specific cheekbones and eye colors and hair colors and chin shape, all the things that when you see somebody in the street, you recognize their face. And so you say, hi, Jim, or hi, Fred.
Yeah.
Well, all of that or a large fraction of it is due to that person's DNA. So if you could look at a person's DNA or just look at DNA of a given person and then from that DNA figure out what their face, their eye color is, their nose shape, their lips, their chin, then you could reconstruct the face of that person and then recognize them in a photograph that you might find on the internet. So the danger is, right now we are anonymizing DNA and giving them out to healthcare professionals so they can help us figure out what genes are associated with which diseases. But at the same time, if we get some nefarious person who says, I got this DNA, it's been anonymized, but I can tell from the genes what their face would look like. I create the face and then try to match it up with a photo on the internet. And this is possible, but so far it's only possible if you get really, really high resolution 3D images of a person's face and then match it up with the DNA. Right now, with the quality of images of people's faces that are available on the internet, it cannot be done. And that was this paper that was written to show that with the given the data that any type of evil scientist would have, they are still not able to do that. And we don't have to worry yet, but it's something that's coming.
It's coming. Yep, it's coming. All right, Charlie, great stuff and terrific to talk. Thank you.
All right. Watch out to who you give your DNA to, though.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.